product marketing manager at Samsung for solid-state drives. And it's my pleasure today to introduce our speaker, a very distinguished gentleman. He spent 30 years in the IT trenches as a consultant in New York. He's designed and built IT infrastructures for organizations including BBDO, which is one of the world's largest advertising agencies that the State University of New York had purchased, and Foxwoods Resort and Casino, where he learned about high availability. He started writing and reviewing products for PC Magazine back in 1986, and has written hundreds of articles for trade publications, including Network World, Information Week, and his current journalistic home, Network Computing, where he's written for more than 20 years. He's currently founder and chief scientist at Deep Storage, a storage industry analyst firm and independent test lab. At Deep Storage, he runs storage gear through its paces and gets to do fun things like test if scale-out storage system actually continue running if one node is destroyed by thermite. With fellow storage analyst Ray Duchesi, he co-hosts the Graybeards on Storage podcast and is frequently a highly rated speaker at conferences, including here at the Brown Memory Center. So please give a warm welcome to Howard Marks.
Made me sound really qualified, didn't it? And for those of you who are interested, that's what happens when you destroy a node from a scale-out storage system with thermite. The best part is, while I did a couple of test runs with the thermite to figure out how much I needed and what size flower pot to use, that was the first time we did it with the power on the server on. And this is the perfect still because the molten iron is coming out of the bottom, but the fans haven't yet failed. So it's blowing a huge cloud of black smoke out the back. So today we're going to talk about the progress of flash in the data center. You know, 3 or 4 years ago when I started this, we were really talking about how flash was entering the data center, and flash is now SOP. So we're talking today about things like how flash moves beyond tier zero, how 3D NAND has made TLC acceptable in the data center, the rise of PCIe with NVMe. I'm going to talk for a minute about persistent memory expanding beyond flash itself because the state of persistent memory has changed in terms of standardization. And then I'm going to spend a significant amount of time talking about what I'm calling the new tier zero, a new generation of systems that move performance an order of magnitude beyond what we have become accustomed to with the all-flash array. While it is traditional at events like this to ask you to hold questions till the end, that is difficult for me. I am from New York. Raising your hand is way too polite. If you have a question, just shout it out. If it is a stupid question, have no doubt I will let you know. And, you know, the first and clearest point about the data center in 2016 is that flash has won. Over 85% of the most traditional disk-based platforms ever made, the VNX and the NetApp FAS, ship with some flash. And that's been true for about 3 years, and the percentage of flash in those systems is increasing. And if you have detailed questions about that, Eric Berenger, back from IDC, would be glad to sell you some reports or a subscription. But today, even the low-end SMB systems, even the $15,000 or $20,000 disk array, has some flash for acceleration. And in cases like vSAN, it is possible to build all flash configurations that are actually less expensive than the more typical hybrid configurations because vendors are starting to offer data services like data reduction only on their all flash environments where functions like data deduplication don't have the huge performance hit that they do with spinning disks. So while a 4 terabyte SSD still costs 10 times as much as a 4 terabyte spinning disk by the time you calculate in the cost of software and the benefits of data reduction, the usable cost can actually be lower for an all-flash system. Part of this also comes from the differentiation that's occurred in the SSD market, where we can now buy very low endurance, very high capacity, very high capacity SSDs for the enterprise, where 3 or 4 years ago, the only SSDs that had the power fail circuitry that we felt was required to put them in a server also had very high endurance ratings because the SSD industry was sure that any SSD that wore out in any data center would ruin the whole idea of flash in the data center and people would rapidly revert to hard drives. The boogeyman of endurance is now known to be a boogeyman. I was at a HP Analyst Day event and we asked, what percentage of SSDs wear out? And one of HP's product managers got online and dove into their online analytics database and told us that over 85% of all the SSDs HPE has sold into the data center still have over 90% of their life left. So endurance, people don't write nearly as much data as they believe they do, and so endurance is a smaller problem than people have believed that it was. Flash is also a big deal in the cloud, which isn't really the focus of this discussion, but if you spin up an instance in EC2, the ephemeral storage is now flash. So the cost benefits are, so that Amazon has decided that simply providing flash is less expensive to them than providing users an option of having a higher cost flash option and a lower cost spinning disk option. We're starting to see the effect of that in applications that are becoming more and more adept at using a small amount of flash to buffer data that's accessing a larger, slow data set. And if you think about an EC2 instance, you have a small amount of ephemeral flash, and then you're talking to S3, which is kind of the definition of slow storage. We can also see the scale of flash winning by its impact on the hard drive market. The 10 and 15K hard drives are dying rapidly, and the only category of hard drives that continues to grow in sales is the 7200 RPM nearline drive. The consumer drives are falling off because things are bad in the oil-producing countries, and tablets have influenced PC sales, so PC sales are down, and therefore PC hard drive sales are down. 10 and 15K RPM sales are down because flash has replaced them. The only sweet spot for the drive manufacturers is still the very large capacity, relatively slow disks. And if you look at research, you can see that every vendor claims to be a market leader. This is more about how vendors can read analysis and how analysts define markets than it is about reality. But we'll leave that aside. In the market, we can see a continuing consolidation. NetApp recently purchased, well, not all that recently, but last year, purchased SolidFire, one of the leading technology firms in the all-flash array market. Western Digital, knowing that their hard drive business has a limited life of profitability, decided to absorb SanDisk and puts Western Digital in a unique position of having the OEM relationships from the hard drive business and now also owning a flash foundry. This does not seem to bode well for Seagate, who is in the position of trying to work their way into the solid state disk market from the hard disk market without having the deep pockets and the resources of having their own fab. And, of course, in the largest deal in the IT industry, Dell is absorbing EMC. In addition, legacy systems are going all flash, and the advantage of an all-flash legacy system is the rich set of data services that are built into those legacy systems. You know, it took a good 6 to 8 years for the storage vendors to build proper support for flash into their legacy systems. The first and second generations of flash-based storage systems designed for hard drives that had the hard drives replaced with flash were frankly abysmal. And the general consensus from the analyst community was that you should buy a system that was designed for flash from the beginning, because the systems that were designed for hard drives that now use flash were so bad at using flash. And that was so bad at using flash meant two things: that if they didn't deliver comparable performance to built from scratch all-flash system, that they still have some disabilities in data reduction, so costs are higher. But the third factor, which you know, is less of a problem today, is that they were not kind to flash being designed around disk drives and basic RAID. There was a lot of write amplification, and so the cost of putting flash in a VMAX or an FAS was very high, because it had to be very high reliability, very high endurance flash, because those systems were just not designed with log-based file structures that would write full pages and reduce the amount of write amplification. These factors have decreased, and in fact, EMC is now making a... That EMC is now making a pivot to promoting the all-flash VMAX more than the extreme I/O in some user cases, because that there's a confidence level. And there are, of course, use cases like mainframe support that only a very small number of storage systems do and ever will support. So in 2010, you know, we were looking for 100,000 IOPS and consistent sub-millisecond latency, and this is what I call the Tier Zero era, where Violin Memory and TMS were shipping what were essentially rack-mount SSDs. They, you know, we couldn't call them a storage array, because they didn't have the data services that we expected from storage arrays. But if you're a high-frequency trader, all you care about is speed. And so there was a market for those products. Over the years, as the flash storage systems have matured, we've now reached the point where we don't talk substantially about flash, we talk about performance, and data services are very important. Of course, the most important data service in terms of making an all-flash system cost-effective is data reduction in terms of compression and deduplication. And those systems like the VMAX that suffer in that have to have some other major advantage. Some of my fellow analysts like to talk about the all-flash data center as if all-flash was inevitable. And in part, they start making references to Facebook. And it's very important to remember that the hyperscalers, most specifically Facebook, have a use case and a set of problems that are completely different than the average corporate data center. That in most organizations, when I have data that is being accessed 1/100th as much as my hot data, that's cold data, and I can put it in a disk-based system that will be plenty fast for accessing my cold data. When you're Facebook, the difference between hot data and cold data is that 4 billion people are accessing your hot data, and only 4 million people are accessing your cold data. So their cold is approximately 100 degrees Celsius, and they require a system that has performance in between what we traditionally expect from flash and what we traditionally expect from disk. The only way for them to do that is with flash, and they're slightly overbuying performance. And personally, I think that the all-flash data center is in the same category as the paperless bathroom. And Adam Osborne once famously said that the paperless office was as likely as the paperless bathroom. That, you know, it might be something to aspire to. You know, basically today we've reached the, if the, for the workloads where latency is an important measure, flash is the answer. There is no good reason to use spinning disks to provide latency. But there are still, a huge amount of cold data, and I can't imagine building an all-flash object store of 100 petabytes to store medical images that may never be accessed again. So long retention disks still make sense. And of course, Kreider's law has not been repealed. So while Moore's law says that we're going to get twice as many transistors per chip every 18 months to 2 years, Kreider's law says we're going to get twice as many bits per square inch on a spinning disk every 3 to 4 years. So we're not chasing a constant cost on a spinning disk. Yes, the cost of flash has been falling at a 30% compound annual rate, but the cost of disk is falling at a 15% compound annual rate, so those lines are not going to meet for some time. Now, if we're talking about data that reduces well, and if my friend Jim Handy, who just did the previous session update on flash, is correct, and there is a massive oversupply of flash manufacturing coming in 2018 or 2019, that's going to cause a massive drop in flash prices. And in that 2019-2020 period, we may actually see that crossover. The problem with flash is that every generation of flash becomes less expensive, and here I'm talking about planar flash, but every generation of planar flash is less expensive because the dimensions of the cells shrink and we can therefore get more bits per wafer, and that reduces manufacturing costs. The problem is that in every other way, other than cost, shrinking the size of a flash cell reduces its quality. The smaller cells, especially for MLC and TLC, require longer write times. They hold fewer electrons, so that any electron leakage has a greater impact on data integrity. They have thinner insulating layers, and so the wear on the insulating layer caused by a high voltage page erase results in lower endurance. So as flash has gotten cheaper, it's also gotten crappier. And this is a problem that we can be grateful that the controller vendors have been hiding from us, that the quality of the digital signal processing and error correction codes in the controllers has improved at least as fast as the quality of flash has fallen off. So when we look at a fully packaged SSD, we're not seeing this problem. However, we reached a point where before TLC became usable in the data center, TLC became much too crappy to use in the data center. Having 100 or 500 write erase cycles of endurance is more than you can hide by building a really good controller. In the switch, the transition to 3D, and remember that the transition to 3D is designed to be a cost transition. The idea is that 3D should eventually, once all of the kinks get worked out of the manufacturing process, be less expensive to manufacture than planar because you can get more bits per wafer. In today's 3D and in the 3D that we can expect to buy for the next 2 or 3 cycles, so till 2021 or so, the cell sizes are substantially larger than in planar flash. Right? The cell size in planar flash is somewhere between 15 and 19 nanometers. And most people, when you first mention 3D to them, assume that we're talking about an apartment building on 57th Street in New York, that where they tore down a brownstone and put a 60-story building in its place, there's one apartment per floor, tall and very skinny. The process for making 3D is so complicated that no one has been able to do that. While that is the ultimate goal that 10 years from now we may see 19 nanometer 3D 400 layer chips. Today we're seeing 32 and 48 layer chips, and they're big fat apartment buildings, not tall skinny apartment buildings. The cell sizes are in the 40 nanometer range. And by having that larger cell size, there's more electrons and we can do TLC in 3D and get the kind of endurance that we get from MLC in planar. So TLC is now moving into the data center. And as of today, the only volume source of 3D NAND is Samsung, and Samsung's 3D NAND is only available to Samsung's captive SSD division, which is why Samsung has 40% or more of the total SSD market. But Micron is currently shipping in small quantities their 3D. SK and Toshiba SanDisk are in the process of sampling, so 3D should become much more normal over the next 18 months to 2 years. The other big change has been a... Yes, sir. I told you, raising your hand is way too polite.
Yeah, Intel is sampling as well.
Intel and Micron are essentially one foundry.
No, they have their own fab now in China, and they're sampling from their own fab in China.
Thank you, sir. So, the other change that's... Yes, ma'am. Is there a representative from Toshiba in the room? Can I be corrected one more time? Okay.
Howard, can I go back to a separate question you talked about? When do you see that the ability of all of the NAND capacity, whether 2D or 3D, to have enough capacity to meet data needs where you don't need hard drives anymore? Because that's one of the other issues, is there's not the ability to make enough flash to meet the storage needs.
The problem with the whole flash foundry capacity argument is that it ignores price. That the amount of, you know, that their demand is not a global function, demand is a function of price. And so at even half the cost of current flash, you would not replace the entire disk drive. You know, you could, the demand for disk drives would not disappear if the cost of flash fell by 50% immediately. And so the question of when will there be enough flash fab to put Seagate and Western Digital out of the spinning disk business, well, that is the same question as when will flash be cheaper than the spinning disks, because there won't be demand for that capacity until it meets that price point. That it's not, you know, we're not still buying hard disks because there isn't enough flash in the world. We're still buying hard disks because flash is too expensive. And as the cost of flash comes down, demand will increase and they'll build more fabs. But it's a cost-driven function. It's not a megabyte-driven function.
I'd like to comment on that as well. It's an interesting question because in working with OEMs, right, I've had that question posed. Because people who look at the size of the hard disk drive industry in terms of their capacity, in terms of scale, it's much larger than the NAND industry today. But a lot of that is shipping into the 7200 RPM market, where, you know, the price point is pennies per gigabyte. And that's not the market that the NAND industry is going after right now. So if you look at the capacity, if you replace every PC out there in the world today with a 256 gigabyte SSD and all the 15K, all the 10K, there's no problem with scale in the NAND industry.
So the data center use of flash interfaces has been interesting. There was a move towards PCIe with Fusion I.O. cards because of performance. Customers soon realized that while PCIe delivered higher performance, SATA drives delivered sufficient performance at a much lower cost. And so we've seen a transition in many organizations from PCIe to SATA. However, I see a substantial market for PCIe in the storage array business, for shared storage, where the aggregate demand of IOPS is substantially larger than any one server can provide. The problem with PCIe and shared storage has been that nobody wants to have a shared storage system that they open up and change PCIe cards from the top when you can only have 4 or 6 PCIe cards. U.2 moves PCIe to the 2.5-inch canister, makes old storage guys like me comfortable because I can now, do hot swap. And theoretically, you can hot swap PCIe cards. That's been in the PCIe spec since 1.2. However, I have never met anybody with the intestinal fortitude to pull a server out on the rails, open it up, and change a PCIe card while it's running. So the spec supports it, but nobody is that brave. And U.2 puts 4 lanes of PCIe on a 2.5-inch canister that is a familiar form factor and allows storage vendors to build a single model that can take SAS or SATA spinning disks, SAS or SATA hard drives, or PCIe hard drives, and therefore have one controller and one enclosure that addresses a very broad performance range. So today, the largest devices available are... Today, the largest devices available are beyond the capacity of spinning disks. So you can now buy a essentially 16 terabyte 2.5-inch SSD when the largest 2.5-inch spinning disk is only 1.2 terabytes, and the largest spinning disk in 3.5-inch is 10 terabytes. Toshiba today or yesterday announced a 60 terabyte 3.5-inch SSD because the other trend that is occurring is that there's more demand for that intermediate performance level between as fast as I can go by going PCIe and spinning disk, and we're seeing flash solutions for bulk data. If you take one of the 60 drive load from the top 4U enclosures and fill it with 60 terabyte hard drives, we start talking about 3.6 petabytes of flash in 4U, that starts to become very attractive for places like my home of New York, where data center space, literally the cost of rack space, is the limiting factor for many organizations. So they can get density and power advantages by going to these high capacity flash drives. Last year, U.2 was big news. It was the new thing. But U.2, in its initial implementations, was a single port 4-lane PCIe interface. And so that was suitable for servers and the people who roll their own systems, their rack spaces, and HPC data centers of the world thought those were a great idea. But for a storage system, I really need a dual port device so I can have controller failover. Those drives are just coming on the market now and unfortunately are and probably will remain substantially more expensive than comparable capacity from a single port drive just because the market they're selling into is less cost sensitive. Two changes in the SSD market I find very interesting. The first are field configurable SSDs. And anyone who's spent any time looking at the design of an SSD knows that capacity and endurance are a trade-off, that the way you get high capacity, high endurance, is by furthering the over-provisioning of an SSD. Several vendors, including SanDisk and Toshiba, now make 2.5-inch enterprise, and by enterprise I mean with power fail protection and the appropriate capacitance, SSDs with 2 terabytes of capacity that the customer can, in the field, determine whether that's a 1.9 terabyte drive with 0.1 drive writes per day, or is a 1.2 terabyte drive with 10 drive writes per day, by simply setting a firmware flag to determine the model. At least one vendor has been doing that for about a year and a half, but they're having exposed the toggle to the customers. They ship truckloads of drives to Avnet. And Avnet, on as each drive is ordered, puts it into a fixture that sets its endurance and capacity and then applies the right label. So it's 5 models, but it's 1 stock keeping unit. The other interesting development has been host-managed SSDs. One of the problems that a storage system designer faces when building an all-flash system is that the write latency of SSDs varies substantially depending on the state of the SSD. If you write data to an SSD that already has empty pages available, you will get substantially lower latency than if you write changes to an SSD that's in the middle of a garbage collection cycle. Now, many enterprise SSDs address this problem by using larger multi-core controllers and dedicating some small percentage of cores to doing continuous garbage collection, but that is a substantial cost. What host-managed SSDs do is they allow the storage system to tell SSDs when they are allowed to go into a garbage collection cycle. And so you would build a system with, say, 60 SSDs and put them in 3 banks of 20. And only one bank of 20 is allowed to be in garbage collection at a time. All writes go to the other 2 banks, and by cycling who's in garbage collection, you can get much more consistent performance. Right? OCZ announced a series of drives with this support. The T10 and T11 committees are now trying to standardize this process. Unfortunately, the standards process grinds exceedingly fine and therefore takes a long time. So it's probably going to be 2 to 3 years before we see host-managed SSDs with a standard interface. But people building all-flash or substantially flash systems should be looking at how to integrate this technology in their next generation designs. The world is going PCIe, and we are now, a question came up at the end of the last session about whether the number of PCIe lanes provided by the Intel server chipsets was going to be a limitation. And the way that we're addressing that is through standard PCIe chips, switch chips. I forgot to update this slide, so it's not PLX and PMC anymore. It's Broadcom and Microsemi, because there's been a series of acquisitions in this part of the market. And so with a 40-channel PCIe switch chip, we can start building systems that have hundreds of U.2 connected SSDs and have the PCIe performance scale out substantially. The other side of the argument is to say that since flash is non-volatile memory, and since we have new versions of non-volatile memory, like 3D XPoint emerging, that perhaps we should stop treating flash like disk and start treating flash like memory. The one interesting step for that is HP's announcement earlier this year that they're now supporting persistent memory, in this case in the form of an NVDIMM, in ProLiant servers. Before this, getting NVDIMM support required buying specific motherboards from ODMs that major vendors like HP, Dell, and IBM, now Lenovo, did not have the requisite BIOS support. The standards groups around NVDIMMs have built centralized power management in, so these ProLiants have one battery that supports up to 8 NVDIMMs, when you don't have lots of capacitors and wires that you have to hide inside the system somewhere. But what this really means is two things. First of all, as larger capacity and persistent DIMMs made with actually persistent memory, not DRAM and flash and a failover mode, emerge, a new generation of applications will come with them. If you look at things like SAP HANA, we call HANA an in-memory database, and the entire database is held in memory, and all reads are satisfied by memory. But because that's non-persistent DRAM and servers are inherently unreliable devices, any HANA system constantly logs all of its writes to a storage system. And because HANA is ridiculously fast, that storage system has to be ridiculously fast. And SAP deliberate in their putting hardware on their HCL. The performance difference in a 3 or 4 year time when we have NVMe SSDs in those servers or storage class memory on the memory bus, and when a write comes into one node in my HANA cluster, it can be RDMA copied into the persistent memory of another node, we can eliminate the need for that external storage system and get a substantial performance boost to boot. Diablo's been pretty much the first player here. Their products, which put flash on the memory bus, are unfortunately flawed in one way or another. They have two products. They have what they call memory channel flash, which is marketed exclusively by SanDisk as ultra dim. It goes in a dim socket, but it gets accessed by the block driver. And so you have persistence, but you don't really have the performance and capacity. At this point, you know, while I was excited about this technology when it first came out, at this point I'd probably rather have an NVMe SSD than an ultra-dim. And if you have Blade servers, God bless you, and you might have to go that way because you've got no place else to put the NVMe SSD. Memory One, their other product, appears in the memory space, but is non-persistent. And so it is a way to get very large quantities of very slow memory. And I say very slow because the other critical flaw from my point of view of the Diablo technology is that Diablo's intellectual property is a chip that's DDR on the front side and SATA on the back side. So it then talks to a standard Marvell SATA SSD controller before talking to the flash. So the SATA interface becomes the bottleneck. We put this very fast, very broad DDR bus, and then this little skinny SATA channel, and then the flash, so that you're never going to get the performance that the technology promises. Netlist, who was involved in patent litigation with Diablo for years, which has since been resolved in Diablo's favor, is announcing a similar product at the show. I have not had a chance to talk to them about whether it addresses my complaints about the Diablo solutions. So, in 2005, 2006, 2008, we talked a lot about Tier 0 and Tier 0 applications and solutions from companies like Texas Memory Systems and Violin that provided performance but did not provide a substantial set of data services. And that old Tier 0 was 100,000 IOPS at less than 1 millisecond of latency. Today, every all-flash system can deliver hundreds of thousands of IOPS at sub-millisecond latency, and many of those all-flash systems, whether they're built from flash by startups or are adaptations of legacy arrays, have a rich set of data services available to them. So there's no reason for somebody to buy a feature-poor system in the 200,000 to 500,000 IOP 1 millisecond latency range. The nature of the computing business, however, is that there are always a small number of very rich customers who have very high performance requirements. Right? High performance trading is kind of the most obvious of those applications. And if you're making $100,000 a minute, it doesn't matter whether that storage system costs $1 million or $5 million. That's the difference between half an hour and an hour's worth of trading. So we now have a new class of tier zero solutions coming to market that are an order of magnitude faster than what we previously called tier zero.
Yeah, Matt.
Thank you. That all that AV squad in junior high school is paying off. And so in the time remaining, I want to spend a few minutes talking about some of them. One of the major drivers for these tier zero systems and the standard emerging for these tier zero systems is NVMe over Fabric. So NVMe, for those of you who are not fully up on it, is a software interface for PCIe SSDs that is much cleaner than using SAS or SATA. The sad truth is that before NVMe, SSDs either came in a proprietary format that required software to run some of the flash translation layer on the host CPU, the Fusion I/O Virtus one. And while those products offered some unique features, they also were very expensive because the controllers were built out of FPGAs and ASICs, which are an expensive way to go for a low-volume product, and because they consumed host CPU resources. The other PCIe SSDs that were on the market before NVMe used as their programming interface ACHI, the command set designed for SATA hard drives for home PCs. And ACH... I didn't kick any cables that time. And ACHI is a high overhead. It takes a lot of CPU instructions, which means that it adds a substantial amount of latency, on the order of 40 or 50 microseconds, to every access. So the NVMe has been around now for a few years, and all of these tier zero systems, with the exception of EMC's DSSD, which is built around completely custom-built components, use NVMe hard drive, NVMe SSDs as their storage medium. The coming standard is NVMe over Fabrics. And I would say there are several sessions on NVMe over Fabrics here at the Flash Memory Summit, and I suggest that pretty much everyone attend one of them, because NVMe over Fabrics extends the low latency, low overhead NVMe protocol over RDMA networks. And so those of you who come from the high performance computing world hear me say RDMA network and think Omnipath or InfiniBand. Both are supported. Those of you who come from the corporate world hear me say RDMA networks and don't have any idea what I'm talking about. But 10 gigabit, most 10 gigabit Ethernet cards today support one or the other of two standards for doing remote direct memory access over Ethernet. Either IWARP, which is based on IP and does not require anything beyond basic Ethernet, or RoTE, RDMA over converged Ethernet. The converged there means the data center bridging extensions that were built into Ethernet to support FCOE and make Ethernet lossless. The truth is, I have yet to see a 10 gigabit or faster Ethernet switch that I would put in a data center that did not support data center bridging. So the arguments from the IWARP guys about, well, if you need these special switches and it's very expensive, seems spurious to me. Now, it's true, it does take me about an hour to set up 3 or 4 switches in a network for a test configuration to properly support DCB, but that's also because I do it about once every 6 months and I haven't been a professional network guy in 15 years. Your network, you know, somebody who works with Cisco switches all the time, and you tell them, turn these 6 features on in all of these switches, should not take nearly that much time. I have to look up every command in the manual as I type them in. The NVMe over Ethernet standard was finalized in June. So none of these products actually run standard NVMe over Ethernet. It's just too soon. These systems do take unique approaches to how they deliver performance, however. Aperion, who I must admit I always read in my head as Ape Iron, is one of a class, it is an example of a class of solutions that appears every time there's a new technology. And that's guys who think that the network is the place to solve the problem. And when iSCSI was new, we had products like QLogic made a dedicated hardware HBA for iSCSI because, of course, computing the iSCSI overhead in the CPU would be so much work that nobody would want to do that. By the time iSCSI actually came to market, running iSCSI required 2% of CPU utilization, and there was no market for that HBA. Astute Networks built custom iSCSI processing chips for their all-flash array. Since none of you have heard of Astute Networks, you can see how well that worked. And so Aperion is taking a similar network-based approach. Their enclosure has 2 canisters that hold what storage guys would call controllers, but those controllers are much more network-centric, forwarding requests to the SSDs than they are what we think of as controllers. There are 16-port 40-gig Ethernet switches in each canister, so you can connect up to 16 servers. They run their own NVMe over Ethernet, not NVMe over Fabric protocol. NVMe over Ethernet is kind of the closest equivalent is there was an outfit called CoRaid that made systems that ran ATA over Ethernet. Anytime somebody has their own protocol and thinks that their own protocol is a really good idea, as opposed to we have our own protocol because the standards aren't ready yet, I again start thinking this may be problematical or may have some, you know, it either has to have such a huge, unique advantage that it pays off, or it's just a bad idea. And I have not made a final decision, but based on previous experience and how many of these things have been bad ideas, I'm not terribly hopeful. The leader in this market, because they are an 800-pound gorilla, is EMC. And 2 years ago, when I first got briefed on DSSD, I was convinced that the DSSD architecture was the future. DSSD is a rack-scale, all PCIe solution. So the 5U DSSD appliance has 96 PCIe ports, one on each controller for up to 48 servers. Does not scale beyond that. So you can have 48 servers, period. But by using straight PCIe, they can put NVMe commands directly on that bus, and it looked like the best thing since sliced bread. Of course, it requires a lot of custom chips because nobody else does anything like this. So they're taking PCIe switch chips and assorted things they build themselves, and it does deliver the millions of IOPS at 100 microsecond latency that I'm calling the requirements for Tier 0, but it is also a very expensive solution because all that custom hardware has to be amortized over the small number of systems any Tier 0 provider is ever going to create. The advantage that DSSD has in the cloud-native application world is it's not just a block device. You can talk to it through APIs as a key-value store and assorted other ways that may deliver that sub-100 millisecond, 100 microsecond latency, not just for Getty Block 4702, but for Getty Smith, which would be a wonderful thing. You know, it's an object store on the back end. E8 is now running a non-standard version of NVMe over Fabrics, and has said that they're going to be standards compliant in the near future. They have a dual controller system with 24 U.2 SSDs in the front. It offers basic data services like snapshots. Mangstore is interesting because they have plays in three of the hot areas in non-volatile memory. They make their own NVMe SSD and their own NVMe controller. They use Everspin STMRAM for the write cache on that SSD instead of DRAM. So MRAM, like 3D XPoint, is one of the contenders to be the next big thing in universal memory. By using MRAM, which is bit addressable like DRAM but non-volatile, they avoid having to have the capacitors and power fail circuitry because the system is inherently persistent. Finally, they have been one of Intel's lead development partners in NVMe over Fabrics. So far, all of the products I've talked about are, while they may be defined by their software, are sold as hardware. Accelero is trying to address the HPC and other roll-your-own market, the places where cash is less available than skilled people. So universities, high-performance computing labs, very large web-scale guys, the people who have the PhDs to run Ceph, and are delivering software that runs in a Linux machine, can run bare metal so you can build dedicated storage nodes, or can run hyper-converged. And in the hyper-converged mode, it uses what VMware calls I/O Direct Path. That means the PCI device is owned by the VM, and I/O to and from the SSD does not go through the hypervisor, so the low latency remains available. So what do I see coming? Well, I see more and more all PCIe systems. And here, I don't mean all PCIe in the DSSV mold. I, having seen NVMe over Fabrics and the performance that NVMe over Fabrics delivers, I think the flexibility of running over Ethernet and over 40 gig or 50 gig Ethernet being able to deliver the kind of bandwidth and the 100 microsecond latency required makes systems that have the limitations and the costs of DSSVs much less attractive. So I'm thinking of systems that have all PCIe flash with more conventional Ethernet interfaces, whether that's NVMe over Fabric, and I fully expect to see systems that support, you know, 3 or 4 years from now, that support NVMe over Fabrics and iSCSI so that you can have high and low performance access to the same system. Next gen memories, whether we're talking about PCM or 3D XPoint, are going to take substantially longer to enter the data center than people imagined. Last year, Intel made their announcements about 3D XPoint, and I started hearing people saying that they were putting their plans for new storage systems on hold, waiting for 3D XPoint. Well, while waiting for 3D XPoint will hopefully not be as onerous a task as waiting for Godot, 3D XPoint will first appear in SSDs under the Optane brand name. And Jim Handy, who did the last session, wrote a blog post about that was titled, Why 3D XPoint SSDs Will Be Slow. And by slow, he meant not the 1,000 times faster than NAND that Intel and Micron claim for 3D XPoint, because that 1,000 times faster than NAND is chip for chip, not device for device. And even with the low latency inherent in NVMe, talking to an NVMe device means that you're going to have 20 to 40 microseconds of latency, even if the memory on that device has no latency at all, that the in and out overhead is on the order of 20 to 40 microseconds. Since today's... Yes, sir?
Also, I heard the Optane is using it as a cache, not as the main memory on that SSD.
I cannot say anything about unannounced products from vendors I have contractual relationships with.
Okay.
Right, but one would certainly imagine that if I was trying to build a high-performance, cost-effective SSD, that 10% cross-point, 90% flash might be a good idea. But it will be at least another year before Micron and Intel deliver DIMMs with 3D crosspoint, and before there's the proper support in motherboards and operating systems to support multiple performance levels of memory on the same DDR bus. That while Optane is 1,000 times faster than flash, it's still substantially slower than DRAM. And while it's bit addressable, and that is a wonderful thing for new classes of applications, there's hardware support required to know that when the processor writes to this memory location, it's going to take 4 microseconds, not 200 nanoseconds. And that just is not in the current generation of servers. Of course, since Intel controls what goes into the next generation of servers, I'm pretty sure both of these technologies, the crosspoint on DIMM and the motherboard support, will appear at approximately the same time. And of course, that's going to open the door for using more persistent memory as memory and implementing things like SAP HANA in the way I discussed earlier. Well, that brings us to the end of my prepared remarks. Hopefully, some of you have been too polite to just shout out questions. Well, in the words of the great Andy Kaufman, thank you very much.
Actually, I do have a question for our speaker.
Okay.
So you mentioned 3D crosspoint technologies such as that to address, you know, some of the latency challenges we have. So what do you see as some of the challenges for adoption of next-gen technologies such as 3D
cost?
Okay.
Yeah, if 3D crosspoint costs 10% more than DRAM, then it is usable in the ways we currently use NVMEs.
Okay.
And that's a very small one. For 3D crosspoint to have any substantial market penetration, it has to be half the cost of DRAM, which would put it at about 3 or 4 times the cost of NAND. That is still a small market. The large market comes when 3D crosspoint is 2 to 3 times the cost of NAND. And we can now say I'm willing to pay twice or three times as much to get that performance. That today, I can use DRAM and get the performance. I can't get the volume of DRAM that I need into a server, although today's servers hold terabytes of DRAM, so we're still, you know, have to resolve ourselves to the thought, to getting beyond the thought that, you know, well, you only have a couple of hundred gigabytes of DRAM. But, you know, like anything else, like I was talking about the hard drive SSD transitions, it all comes down to cost.
Okay. So for those interested, actually, I will be talking about an upcoming product from Samsung tomorrow after we've made our announcement that addresses some of the challenges related to that, but without the need to switch to exotic memories. The forum is C22, SSD Concepts, tomorrow at 3:50 in the afternoon. Yes?
I have a question for you. Would you engage in some idea of the security concerns with these activities as applied to the enterprise storage?
Well, historically, when you talk about storage security, we're talking about encryption. And there are two areas of encryption we need to worry about: encryption at rest and encryption in flight. encryption in flight is, 3 years ago I would have said encryption in flight is stupid, because the fiber channel SAN never leaves your secure data center. And you encrypt because in flight because you're worried about a man in the middle attack. If you properly secure the middle, that encryption becomes unnecessary. The truth is, if I want to get your Oracle database, I'm not going to attack the VMAX the Oracle database is on. I'm going to attack the Oracle server the database is on. And so encrypting between the Oracle server and the VMAX didn't make a lot of sense. However, as we start entering the hybrid cloud era, we now open up the middle, and the middle is available. And how we encrypt in the middle is a problem the storage guys have mostly left to the network guys. Because by the time it gets to the router to go to the cloud, it's Ethernet, and they can encrypt it there. When we talk about encryption at rest is generally a protection in the terms of drive disposal. I have a hard drive that died. It has the social security number of everybody who visited my hospital in the past 20 years. If I just throw it out, I have to send every one of those people a letter that says that I may have put your data at risk. And when the Health and Hospitals Corporation in the city of New York had a box of tapes stolen out of a courier truck, they had to send out those letters in 22 different languages at a cost of $12 million. If that drive is encrypted, the laws that require that notification explicitly say, if the data is encrypted, don't worry about it. In addition, even if the drive hasn't died, wiping a hard drive is technically simpler than wiping an SSD because of over-provisioning. There are hidden pockets of flash that, you can't be absolutely sure you've overridden the whole thing. The vast majority of enterprise drives today include secure arrays and effectively encrypt internally to the drive. And when you say secure arrays, they throw that encryption key away and they generate a new encryption key and the data is effective.
Can I follow up on a slightly different angle on that as well?
Sure.
Would you also engage on the power requirements on the enterprise class applications? And the second part is the role of technology as the shrinkage of the size goes on in terms of the redundancy and overbuilt requirement that you would have on SSD.
Well, in terms of, as NAND gets crappier, how much I need to over-provision the SSDs, I leave to SSD designers. I am a storage guy, and I understand flash only well enough to be able to make gross decisions. The people who make it, I assume the people who make SSDs know better than I, if they want to deliver 3 drive bytes per day of endurance, what that means in terms of over-provision. And I forgot the first half of your question.
Power.
So the flash folks talk a huge amount about how they save power, but that's relative to the ridiculously high power consumption of short strokes 15K RPM drives. And so the first generation, when you replace 100 short stroke SSD drive, 100 short strokes 15K RPM drives with one SSD, you get a huge power improvement. When you replace your first generation of SSDs with second generation of SSDs, you get a little bit of a power improvement. The big case with power, the main concern is that we now have NVMe and other PCIe SSDs that draw the limit of what the slot can deliver. And I've seen PCIe SSDs that use the little extra power connector that's designed for gaming video cards so that they can draw 30 or 40 watts instead of the 25 watts that a PCIe slot can deliver. Even at 25 watts, cooling can be a problem. I live in Santa Fe, New Mexico, where it's 7,000 feet elevation. And Viridant gave me some of their cards for some of my servers. And I cannot run the Viridant cards in my 1U Supermicro servers because the fans don't move enough air with the lower air density at altitude to cool them. While we're at altitude, SSDs are a great idea for altitude because spinning disks only work up to about 10,000 feet, that the air density is not high enough for the heads to fly above approximately 10,000.